always have this. Are you just going to
I just like the way you do it.
All right.
I mean, I can do it for you. You ready?
All right.
But this time you have to do it like straight face.
I don't know if I can.
I'm going to say like this. I'm going to say, what's up, everybody? This is Josh Yellen and the Sports Medicine Broadcast.
Or I can just do it. Whatever.
It's your show.
All right, here we go. 3, 2, 1. What's up, y'all? Welcome to the Sports Medicine Broadcast, Epidemiology and Sports Injuries with Dr. Mitzi Laughlin and Dr. Josh Yellen. Dr. Josh Yellen is, of course, here. And it's a pleasure to have you back, Mitzi.
Thank you.
So, I'm your host, Jeremy Jackson, and my students will be here in just a little bit. We are celebrating National Athletic Training Month when this is being recorded. If you want to join the conversation, sportsmedicinebroadcast.com. This will be sportsmedicinebroadcast.com/epidemiology. So, epidemiology, sportsmedicinebroadcast.com/epidemiology. We're going to start off with, I Googled a definition for epidemiology, and then we're going to work off of that. All right. My definition that I have is the branch of medicine that deals with the incidence, distribution, and possible control of diseases and other factors relating to health. Okay. So that's the general definition there on Google. And now we're going to go to Mitzi. Mitzi, what's your take on that definition? And then how would you kind of make that more specific to what you're doing?
Okay. Technically, that definition is correct. It's all-encompassing. What I use as my definition for my little part of epidemiology looking at sports injury is what everyone is thinking when the injury bug bites, when you have that fifth ACL tear of the year. That's more of the epidemiology that I work with of sports injuries. And, you know, yes, sometimes people have injuries that kind of go in patterns. You know, one year it's the knee and next year it's the shoulder and back and forth. Is that a real issue, or is that, you know, is there a training issue behind that, or is it really just, you know, bad luck and you're going to get all the knee injuries for the next 5 years and the next 3 months? So that's kind of what my definition of it is, kind of when you get those injury bugs and you seem to get the same injury over and over.
Yeah, and as athletic trainers, we always discuss that. Yeah, man, we had 5 ACLs, or yeah, we had 10 concussions this year. And I guess there is really good, you know, some people like you enjoy looking at those numbers and figuring out, is there a pattern? And me, it's like, we'll see, whatever. It is what it is.
So let me, first of all, let me, if you don't mind, my mom is listening in California. So her name is Heidi Yellen. Everybody, hi, Heidi Yellen. Shout out to Heidi. And so Mitzi represents two of the areas that I think in athletic training, or one of the two areas that I think in athletic training, that if you understand these two areas, you'll separate yourself from everybody else. One is understanding the research and statistics. Okay, that's one. The other is within that domain five, right? The now it's healthcare administration, professional development. But let's just focus on the research and the statistics, okay? So exactly the difference between your two thought paradigms. One says, well, we just had a bad year. And another one says, let's investigate this a little bit more and see, did we do something or did we not do something to cause this event, right? Because everybody knows, you've been around long enough to understand that sometimes you just have a bad year. And I call it, you know, the world decided to open up and swallow you whole. It just happens, right? And there is no real reason. But if we really kind of take the root word of epidemiology, right? And I extend a little bit and I say epidemic. Can we start to prevent some epidemics? So when a team consistently has, or a population consistently has, ankle issues, knee issues, concussion issues, shoulder issues, right? All of these different things. That's where your understanding of statistics and research really come in. So give us some examples, Mitzi, if you don't mind, of some of the areas that you can apply your specialty in training and why it's so important for athletic trainers to understand. Besides the fact that, by the way, the rest of the medical village medicine is already functioning off of epidemiology.
Mm-hmm. Well, in sports medicine, it's important to look at the numbers of injuries and to see if there's a pattern, because we want to prevent, as athletic trainers, we want to prevent injuries. And the first thing that people look at is the environment around there. Prevent heat illness in fall football practices, whether it's more injuries on turf than grass. That was a big topic back in the late 80s, early 90s, when all the high schools were starting to put in artificial turf fields. Were they having more injuries? That's a lot of where the sports epidemiology started, and it was the difference in playing surface.
And so the result of that was what?
That there are a few more injuries on turf, but they're different types of injuries than there are on grass. The traumatic injuries of two players hitting each other are exactly the same. There's a different interaction between the footwear on turf as there is on grass to have different types of the injuries to the ankle and the knee.
And so did those injuries show more season-ending injuries? Did they show more, you know, if we were to look at micro and macro types of injuries?
I'm not sure that they showed more season-ending injuries. It was just a different type of injuries. There was a few more injuries on unofficial turf, but I don't like getting into it sometimes on telecasts like this, but, you know, it was not statistically significant.
Okay.
So there was a little bit of difference, but it wasn't a huge difference.
Okay.
But the injuries were different.
Sure. Okay. Along those lines, tell us some other ways that epidemiology is being applied in athletic training and really talk about why it's so important.
Okay. It's mainly it's being applied when the injury bugs hit.
And define for us, what is an injury bug?
The injury bug is when, you know, you're halfway through the season and somebody declares in the middle of the training room, this is the year of shoulder dislocations, because that's what you're doing, that's what you're rehabbing every day. The first couple ones you don't notice because, you know, having one shoulder dislocation in fall football, okay, you don't want that to happen, but it happens. You know, law of averages, you're going to have one every couple years. But once you see your third or fourth during that same year, then light bulbs start going off. And there's two different schools of thought and two different reactions to it, depending on if you're more of a clinical athletic trainer or if you're more of a researcher athletic trainer. If you're a clinical athletic trainer, you buy more supplies and you just know you're going to do more shoulder rehab in the off season. You take care of the patients and all. If you have more of a research hat on, you start looking at, you know, are these numbers abnormal? What do they look like, you know, from seasons past? What have we changed? Looking at all the reasons possibly why these numbers may be different.
You know, you bring up a word, you know, you call it the research hat, but as you just described it, it's more of a problem-solving hat. So can you elaborate a little bit more as to why the clinical athletic trainer, those that are still practicing, need to have such an understanding of not necessarily in-depth the research and statistics that you know, but have an understanding of, you know, basic research, basic statistics, and put on that problem-solving hat?
Right. The clinical athletic trainer does a great job of taking care of the athlete. That's the number one priority. And they've got that hat of they are going to take care of the athlete, and whatever is thrown at them, they take care of the athlete. And the second hat, the research hat or the statistics hat, that the clinical athletic trainer also needs is an understanding of the research and an understanding of when something, even if they're pretty much a clinical athletic trainer and going to take care of the athlete, to say something to a researcher, hey, we might have a problem here. I'm not saying that they have to go through all the steps of figuring it out, but they need to they need to know when to ask for help and to say, hey, we might have a problem.
So not just saying, well, this was just a bad year, but to be able to say, look, we're having a specific type of injury.
Exactly.
And that I need to figure out, I need to understand at a deeper level why this is happening.
Yes. And they need to know to go for help. And then the clinical athletic trainer is invaluable on looking at the reasons why things might have happened. Was there a change in training? You know, was there a change in strength coaches? Was there a change in equipment? Was there a change in, you know, they waxed the gym floor differently this year? I mean, there's a thousand different things that could be different, or you could have that coach that we've done the same thing for 30 years also. And that clinical athletic trainer is going to be the one to give that insight on possible reasons why this is happening.
So, Jeremy, can you give some examples, right? You're a practicing athletic trainer.
Right.
Can you give some examples to Dr. Laughlin about some of those injury bugs that you've had, right, that you've experienced in football, baseball, basketball?
All right. Well, most people say that girls soccer has the highest number of concussions, but here at Pasadena High School, it is girls softball. Now, we know that part of that is inexperience, so some of them just can't catch a ball.
And
right?
they
and some of them can't
And so they try to catch it with their head.
Right, or, you know, they have the glove in front of their face, and it goes off the top of the glove into their face, or we've had a kid throw a ball, hit a tree, bounce off the tree, hit a girl in the head.
Wow.
You know, or bounce off the cage. Yeah. And so concussions is one of those they're like, oh my gosh, I think we might add like 10 last year just from softball.
Really?
Yeah. And so it's one of those things you have to look at. Well, are we talking to the coaches? Are they being supervised? Are they wearing helmets? And but I wouldn't say that we went and like observed every practice or put a whole lot into it other than, coach, you got something going on. We got to figure out. Uh-huh. Couple years ago, we had, I think, 5 ACLs in the first semester.
For what sport?
There was football and girls and boys basketball. So it was just all in the beginning of the year. So that was maybe more of like the injury bug because it wasn't a specific thing. Obviously, I don't know if you can ever call ankle sprains since it's the number one sports injury. But I know that this year we did a functional movement screen with Dr. Phelps from Arosti with the varsity boys basketball. Mm-hmm. And we only had one non-contact ankle sprain in all of varsity basketball. So one guy stepped on somebody coming down from a rebound. That just happens. Mm-hmm. But the other guy tripped in practice or whatever. And so it's kind of seeing both of those, whereas we reduced the number of injuries or days they were out by doing foam rollers and core exercises and corrective exercises. And then another one where we had to look at, well, there's a whole lot of this. We got to fix what the problem is. So
from an epidemiological standpoint, the concussions in softball, this is just a fluke.
Mm-hmm.
What would you call that in statistics?
If it's just a fluke, it's non-significant.
Yeah.
It's just the law of averages. Now, players that are inexperienced do have a higher injury rate, possibly because of those reasons that they really don't know how to play the game and they're not really up to speed. So I'm not surprised with those, especially when you talk about if they're getting hit by like a ball that bounces off a tree.
And then you have, then he brought up another incident where they had 5 ACLs in the fall, right? A couple from football, a couple from other things.
Mm-hmm.
So from an epidemiological standpoint, how would you address that?
For that one, you'd probably have to go back and see, are there any common
So what are some of those common threads that you think that the clinical athletic trainer needs to know about?
Looking at the experience of the players, looking at the training that the players are doing. It could be that they're all, you know, it was in the fall. Was it right at the beginning of the season?
Mm-hmm.
Did the players not come in any type of shape? Or is it towards the end of the season and the players may be, you know, burned out, overtrained by that time? Are they playing outside sports?
I mean, not outside, like outside.
Not
outside, but outside the sports of the sport that they're.
Right. Are they also playing a club sport at the same time they're playing school sport?
I want to go down the line and address exactly what you talked about from the beginning. What does the research say about the prevention of ACL tears and sprains? Is there one significant factor? So, like, for instance, we know that if there's a hamstring to quad deficit,
mm-hmm.
right?
Hamstring to quad deficit. Landing technique after jumping,
mm-hmm.
especially those individuals, and it usually happens in girls, that land straight-legged and don't absorb the shock in any way.
Now, in females, along those lines, they identified that it used to be that we were always focused on the VMO,
right.
But now we're focused on glute med.
Glute med.
Because of the Q angle.
Mm-hmm.
So from a research standpoint, have you seen any data that supports that, you know, that intervention is working?
Unfortunately not.
Let's stay on this. This is good, right? Because if you look at a lot of rehab protocols now, the thought process, right, when I was coming through, the thought process was VMO, 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 VMO. And then there was somebody at the University of Southern California who's a biomechanist, and he discovered, I don't think it's VMO. I think it's glute med, specifically because of that Q angle. And then it was always glute med, glute med, glute med, because look, you know, as the female lands, you can see the femurs essentially collapse in because those glute meds aren't strong enough to hold, right, the femur in place. But now you're saying, right, from a research standpoint, from an epidemiological standpoint,
that there's really no difference. Now, the problem is on the research like this, to show that there is no difference, you have to have such a large sample size.
Describe that.
Large in epidemiological terms are several thousand. That's one of the problems of taking epidemiology down to like a single sport team. Mm-hmm. Because most sport teams, if you're talking about a football team, you're talking between 50 and 75 or something. If you're talking about a basketball team, you got 12. Now, if you have a varsity, a JV, sophomore, all the way down, you may get to 100 basketball players or something. But epidemiology and a lot of the statistics in epidemiology like thousands of people. And so it's difficult to sometimes show statistical significance, although you think there might be something going on.
And so now we're starting to kind of look at the difference between, statistically speaking, there is significance or non-significance, or is this a random kind of case study?
Correct.
And if it is a case study, what can we learn from it? Although that from a larger sample size, there's really no significant, you know, difference as to whether it worked or it didn't work.
Right. I mean, on the prevention of ACL tears, basically doing anything, whether it's strength training, additional conditioning, proper biomechanics on the individuals that can't land when they jump. I mean, there's just certain individuals that you can watch them when they land and you're like, oh. If you can target those people, the injury rate seems to go down, but there's not a large enough sample size to say that it definitely goes down.
And do you think from, again, just I want to separate the fact, and for those people that don't know, right, Dr. Laughlin was a practicing athletic trainer for a long time. So if I take off your clinical AT hat and I put on your research AT hat and I stay on the ACL and then we apply an intervention like the FMS, right, from your end, keeping that research hat on, the FMS is, you know, we already know that it's valid and reliable, but is the functional movement screen a, I guess, a tool that can actually prevent injuries?
It has not been shown in athletic populations to prevent injuries, but it has been shown in, like, firefighters are the big ones of different departments that come in and they test all the firefighters, you know, from the battalion captain all the way down. And it does have, it does decrease their injury rate and workman's compensation cost and everything. And a lot of that is teaching the firefighters how to lift properly and to make sure that they have more points of contact when they're getting in odd positions.
Here's a little piece of trivia for you.
It's mainly back problems that they're preventing.
All right, correct me if I'm wrong here, Mitzi, but here's a little piece of trivia for you, Jeremy Jackson. Do you know where the FMS was originally, I think, I may be wrong, but was originally used as an intervention with firefighters? It was recently. It was in the 2000s.
Where it was originally used?
Yeah, so there was a big big study. There was a big study that was done with firefighters, and they took the FMS and they actually applied it, and it cut down on the amount of injuries that the firefighters had. It was done with the Orange County Fire Authority in Orange County, California. And they came out with a big study, and they published it, right? And it actually worked. So here's something where, correct me if am I wrong? I think I'm right.
No, you're correct.
Yeah. I'm like Cliff Clavin from Cheers. I have these random facts. And so it's really interesting, right? Because in the athletic population, we use FMS all the time. But what Mitzi's saying is that there is really no significant difference of whether you do it or not. However, the athletic trainer that's in the occupational setting, the FMS is a great tool. And there's research and statistics to support it.
In the same conversation, though, she just said doing anything to help prevent the ACL injuries, any of those programs has shown.
Well, it could be strength training, right?
Right.
And so, like, it could be, like, I could strengthen up my hamstrings. I could just take somebody, right? I could take all of your student athletes, and that's what she's saying. And that's why understanding the statistics are so important, right? That I know a lot of clinical athletic trainers that they read a study or they read something in the Journal of Athletic Training or, you know, a PT journal or a biomechanics journal or the NATA News or, you know, the Houston Chronicle or the LA Times, whatever it is. And then they go and they apply it. But having a deeper understanding of why, you know, what does it do? So what she just said was doing anything. So what happens if I remove squats? What happens if I remove deadlifts? I'm just going to have everybody do knee flexion exercises because I'm going to strengthen up the hamstring. Because I know the hamstring is doing dynamically what that ACL is doing statically. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah.
It does? That's the only exercise that you're going to do?
Well, I thought you were going to continue at that. You said, does that make sense? I was just saying, yes, I'm following you. Sorry. I misunderstood your point.
But my question is...
So is that all you're doing in practice? Yeah, that's hamstring
all,
curls.
Right, that's all we're going to do is hamstring curls.
Oh, well, that doesn't make any sense.
Well, that's what I'm saying is that to be able to decipher through, right? That's the issue that I think that we run into with, you know, within our profession. I can't speak for any other profession because I'm not a part of it. But with our profession, you know, there is a big, and where I'm going with this is the evidence-based practice requirement for what we do. MITSI is a great representation as to why understanding evidence-based practice is so important, right? Is that I can take an idea, I can take an intervention, and I can say, here's how we look at this. Here's what the research and the statistics say. Now, from an epidemiological standpoint, well, we can't necessarily compare it because she's looking at thousands of people, and we may be looking at, like, you know, 12 to 100 at the time. But it's just that thought process of, it's not necessarily understand the research, but it's that problem-solving model. And this, for me, goes into a deeper issue. And the deeper issue is, of all the medical professions, we're the only one that is not part of that medical hospital-based problem-solving model, right? And so she represents, I think, the bridge to understanding that. And she represents, you know, the more people that can think, whether you're going to go into research or clinical or whatever it is, the more people that can understand and think this way, right, the more efficient we become with treatments. Now, I know by saying this, all those people that are listening to your show are probably going to get furious with me, and that's fine. And you can catch me at mslaughlin@central.us, uh.edu.
Thanks, sir.
Yeah. So continue on. That was my little segue.
Where were you?
About the intervention, right? About the...
So all we're going to do is hamstring curls, right, in your workout.
Right. Does that make sense?
No.
Why?
Because there's so much other things that go into making... Let's say it's a basket... We're going to talk basketball player ACL tears. A basketball player needs to be able to do so much more than... Yes, you want to prevent the ACL tear, but you also want to make them a basketball player, which requires quad strength and jumping ability, and you're going to need to do squats and a lot of other exercises and a lot of running and jumping and everything else.
Okay.
And skill work.
Yeah, and so that was kind of my question too, as you brought that up. If you do anything, and then you were talking about the FMS doesn't statistically...
Like, it's a hard word to say.
Where? How do I... As Josh was saying, how do I understand the research or the most effective one if we're talking about basketball player and ACL? Because, I mean, do I have to read through every article and then try and put them all together? Because if I do a jumping program from Dr. Walt Lowe, who, you know, this is what he does for any ACL repair, well, it's also a really good prevention program because it's, again, teaching the kids the mm-hmm. proper landing and that kind of thing. But is that really going to make a difference? So where do I go?
Yeah, it's one of those, you possibly may prevent the injuries on those people that would tear it because of a landing issue. It's not really a jumping. They jump just fine. They just can't land correctly. But you may not be able to prevent all the injuries because there's multiple ways that individuals end up tearing their ACL. Some of it is from, especially in the female athletes, from the femur rotating in. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a different issue. And you kind of have to hit about five different problem areas.
So if you were to combine the two areas that you've really been in, right, a clinical athletic trainer and now a researcher,
mm-hmm.
what sorts of advice would you give those that are practicing? I mean, what would you, because you have an international audience that's listening, and you have those that are practicing in a kind of pediatric population, secondary school, those that are practicing in a collegiate setting, pro setting, occupational setting. What are some nuggets from you that you think that they need to know and how to decipher through all of this, right? Because if I open up a journal, just like Jeremy said, if I open up a journal of athletic training, I see all of this stuff. How do I know what to believe and what not to believe, or how do I know what to do or what not to do?
You have to look at your population and take the research and apply it to your population. And some of the research will not apply. If you're working in the high school setting, some things that they do for the NBA players may not apply because some of those student athletes just don't have that talent. But there's a lot of other things that do. You still have, you know, especially if you're looking at high school athletes, that freshman that hasn't gone through puberty yet. They're more like a junior high athlete that has a different set of problems. And so it's more of matching the protocol or the prevention protocol that you want to do to the population and making sure that they get what they need. And it may be different year to year, and it may be different for athletes.
So I want to transition here for a second. Are you allowed to speak? So for those that don't know, Dr. Laughlin for a long time was at NASA, right? And she's had an opportunity to work with a bunch of different astronauts. And she's still a part of NASA as an epidemiologist.
Correct.
And so are you able to discuss, not in detail and not essentially, are you able to kind of discuss generally?
In general terms, yes.
Yeah, some of the things that you've been able to do and how you've applied your training as an athletic trainer and your training in epidemiology into what you do at NASA and how that has gone to solve some problems.
Okay. In general terms, one of the main projects I worked on the last several years is there was a perception, and this is kind of like the athletic trainer in the middle of the training room deciding this is the year of the ACL or whatever that specific injury is. In the astronaut office, this was a perception in the astronaut office that we seem to have a lot of shoulder injuries. Everyone seems to be hurting their shoulder. So what could it be? And the astronauts looked at it, well, it had to be something that they were doing as an astronaut, whether it was flying airplanes, and the particular, they fly T-38s, and the thing had a manual canopy that they had to pull over.
I'm giggling because I can always hear them ripping out of Edwards.
Ellington,
sorry.
Yeah, Edwards is out in California.
Yeah, that's right. I just got back from California. Yeah, Ellington. And yeah. Okay, go ahead.
So is it that? Is it the suits that they have to wear during spacewalks? The white suits, they're called EMUs during spacewalks. And there's a lot of training that they have to do in the pool during that. And could that be causing the injuries? But they just had a feeling that there were a lot of injuries. So-and-so's had surgery. Someone's, you know, somebody else might need surgery. And they just felt that was a high number for an extremely healthy population. So they brought in the epidemiology group. And I got pulled in several years ago in looking at this issue. And we started looking at each of the factors that might cause injuries.
And what are some of those factors?
So some of the things that actually the astronauts thought of, is it the canopy of T-38? Mm-hmm. Is it the training that they do in the pool for spacewalks? Is it that they're getting older? And in everyday population, 45-year-old males that do work overhead have a fairly high incident of shoulder injuries.
Okay, I want to put you on pause here for a second. Jeremy's an athletic trainer. This year, there's just an abundance of shoulder injuries. I hope not. Everybody's pointing fingers everywhere else. Jeremy, it's your fault because you didn't do enough prehab. You didn't do the FMS. No, it must be the strength coach's fault. It must be the new coach's fault, right? That new coach has got them doing all sorts of drills. It must be what they're eating. It must be the fact that they were playing all these different sports outside. It must be. Okay, continue on.
Well, sometimes you have to look inside too. I think that's where you're going with it, because especially with the astronauts, as they were so healthy for so many years, any little thing throws up a red flag. And so because these individuals are in perfect health when they come into the astronaut program. And so you've got to look at all the different things, what they're doing outside, work, because also individual astronauts are very active. That means they're out and about doing things and have a tendency when you're active to have more injuries than you do if you would just lay on the couch. We have the little saying that it's very hard to sprain your ankle when you're sleeping on the couch. And so when you're out and about, you do have a higher injury rate just because you're out doing things. Not saying that you're not healthier than laying on the couch, but you will get more aches and pains doing that. So we went through, and it was a several-year study, and it's still ongoing, and we hope to publish in the next few months, of astronaut shoulder injuries. Are there more injuries in the astronaut office than in a normal population.
And when you classify normal, you're saying just throughout, like an 18-year-old kid? Or are you saying a specific gender, specific age range?
What we did for the astronaut study is we matched the age range of the astronauts. And so we initially got a population, very large cohort of people, a population of people from the Houston area that had a particular insurance. And it was about 1.1 million individuals between the people that were employed and all their dependents. And then we took those and then matched it by age to the astronauts. Now, the youngest astronaut ever selected was 25 years old. And then, so we cut off, we took anyone that was 25 years old or under, and we took them out. And then the population of normal people at age 65, most people go on Medicare. And so it wasn't really representative of the normal population, this insurance program. So we took anyone age 65 or above out. And that took out a few people in the population, but it took out quite a few astronauts that may not be flying anymore, but were still working in the office and they were still doing administrative roles and everything. So we ended up with a population of 25 to 65 year olds, both genders. But we had to do analysis gender specific because in the astronaut population, 85% of the astronauts are male, 15% are female. Course, in the normal population, you're a lot closer to 50-50. You're actually, in insurance terms, usually about 52-53% female and a little bit less on the males, just because females have a way. Females will be on insurance before males will.
Because we're stubborn. We don't need to go see doctors.
Exactly.
Okay. Go ahead.
So we did an analysis of the normal population to the astronaut injuries, and we actually saw that for initial going to the orthopedist, going to that physician visit, the astronauts do have more visits. But when it comes down to surgery, there was no difference.
And so did you think that the astronauts had more visits just because they had better access?
They could have better access. They could also have, there's a heightened awareness of if their shoulder is hurting, that they need to make sure it's okay before a possible space flight. There's also a heightened referral. There's also the difference in, even though we tried to match as much as we could educationally, the astronauts are very well educated. A lot of them have post-secondary degrees.
Masters, doctorates.
Exactly. And when we're looking at the normal population, it was a group of working professionals, but still the education level was not exactly the same. We couldn't really measure that, but more educated people use the insurance and will go to the physicians more often than less educated. That's been known for some time.
Okay. And so are you able to talk about some of the results that you all found? No. Are you able to talk in very general?
Yes, no, in general.
In very general terms. Very, I'll say, 250,000 mile view terms.
Yeah.
Because that's how high the International Space Station is.
Is it?
Yeah. It's 250 miles up.
You are a plethora of randomness.
Well, it's only because in like 15 minutes I have to actually head down to NASA and work with the athletic trainers that are down there.
Yeah.
But
in general terms, we found that the female astronaut population, that 15%, well, first off, in the entire astronaut population, and we looked at 100% of the astronauts, there's only 338 U.S. astronauts. And so we're looking at 338 people, and then 85% of them were males, so we only have about 45 females. There weren't enough to make any type of reference.
That's when you talked about the end. That's why it's so difficult from a sports setting. Or if I have an N or a sample size of 12 or 75 or whatever, and I try to compare it to the general, that's the reason why it's so hard to make that comparison.
Exactly. And we could not do it in the female population. You just couldn't do it. In the male population, we saw that the male astronauts did go to the orthopedist more often for a shoulder-related complaint than the normal population. You know, and it could be because of all those issues or those things that we already mentioned, that there's a heightened awareness, mm-hmm. that they follow through on medical care better. They have occupational reasons to make sure that they're healthy and all. And they may have better coverage mm-hmm. and not have barriers because of copays or something like that. But the male astronauts did go to the orthopedist more often. But they did not have any more surgery than the normal population. So it looked like they might have gone to the orthopedist more often, but the number of surgeries was the same, making us think that the number of significant injuries was about the same in both populations.
So the end of the story is, as you dug down a little bit deeper, what you found was, it may seem on the surface that we're having more issues, but in all reality, what was happening was that we were just better able to recognize these minor issues so that we can prevent these major issues from happening.
Right. And it goes back down to some of the factors that we have in there. Why this might be is there is a full-time athletic training staff at NASA that treats the astronauts throughout the day whenever their schedule allows. Therefore, they may be getting better care once they have an identified problem that they can resolve it and it does not progress to surgery, where the normal population person does not have that. They may go to therapy for 3 weeks or something, but it's just not the same.
They don't have that kind of access.
Right.
So back to terms of the, I mean, unless you're the athletic trainer with NASA, I don't think Bruce and Stacy are listening right now, but if they are, hi. So essentially what ends up happening is that there may be the idea that maybe in Jeremy's case, there are more concussions this year, or there are more this or more that. But as you dug down deeper and you started to eliminate, in fact, maybe there weren't more concussions. Maybe it was the idea that we're just able to identify the causes of concussion more. And so we're going to flag that person as, you know, we're going to evaluate for a concussion. And the general population, the normal person that doesn't understand the research and statistics would look at that and say, well, you know, we've really had a rash of concussions this year. In fact, we really didn't. You know, as we went deeper, we were just better able to recognize, right? That's good. That's all that stuff. So for all those people that are listening, what are, you know, as athletic training keeps moving into that medical model, right? It just keeps moving and pushing itself. And it's looking more and more like medicine. So we're making that transition out of athletics, where we originated from, and we're moving more and more into medicine. What are some things that you think that the athletic trainers of today and the athletic trainers of tomorrow, they need to know from your world?
Mainly, the athletic trainers need to have a basic understanding of the concepts of statistics and epidemiology. They may not have to perform each step, but they need to be able to read the research papers and interpret what the research papers are saying and then apply it to their own athletic training room and their own athletes. That's the most important thing of being able to understand and apply. And it's the general concepts, and it's not just going to be reading the athletic training literature, because once we move into the medical model, there's the read the physical therapy literature that apply to athletes. Mm-hmm. You know, we're not necessarily dealing with stroke patients, and that's a whole nother set of literature, but reading anything that there is of if it's the shoulder or if it's the Tommy John surgery or whatever the injury is of that time, that the publications are not only in athletic training journals or the two or three most popular sports medicine journals. You may have to go into some of the other journals and be able to read those.
We've got to be able to access journals of athletic training, journals of physical therapy, journals of orthopedics, journals of biomechanics, journals of exercise physiology, journals of psychology, right? Journals of occupational health. All of those things the athletic trainer needs to be able to read and interpret.
Yeah, see, that's the thing. I mean, you said access. I think you said access at first. Like, I can go to the library or whatever and read those, but that doesn't mean I'm going to understand any of it. And, you know, one of the podcasts I listen to is Sports Med Res, because it's sports med research. And so what they'll do is they'll take some of the research articles and then give me, like, the cliff notes. And I'm like, Jeff, that's a great, great service, because I honestly don't understand when I'm reading, you know, all this stuff about population size of sample, and it we can accounted for this control and that kind of. Obviously, I went to college. I have a bachelor's degree in biology. I understand science, but that's it's just not the language that I speak and understand. And so I think that's the hardest part for somebody like me is reading it in a way that I can understand and then being able to apply it.
I don't think that you're alone. I think that
a majority of the population.
Right. I think if you talk to the majority of athletic trainers, they have the same thought that you have. And I think it's a weakness within our profession that we don't have more of it. Now, what I'm going to tell you is that I think throughout my education, maybe I've had 5 research and statistics classes, and I still really have no idea what I'm doing. It's true. Well, I mean, one of the best I think I work with is Mark Knobloch. And Mark has got a phenomenal understanding of this. Mostly, you know, he got his PhD at UH, same place that Mitzi got her PhD and same place that Dan O'Connor, our department chair, got his PhD. I don't think it's a coincidence that they all kind of have that same thought process, right? And then Mark went on and did a 2.5-year postdoc at the Baylor College of Medicine, where he really got a great understanding of this. And I've learned so much just by listening and watching on this end and understanding the research. And at some point, I came up with this thought of, boy, those people that really understand the research and the evidence side of what we do and then can combine that with kind of the business side of what we do, you can make a case for anything. So all of a sudden, you're taking everything that Mitzi's talking about and you apply it to your particular situation. So let's just take the you're an athletic trainer with the Orange County Fire Authority. Now, I've talked to a couple of those athletic trainers. And they go, man, we really are losing a lot of money in personal injury and workers' comp costs with the firefighters. I mean, we're paying this amount of money out. And you bring somebody in who understands the research, the statistics, the epidemiology. And they go, okay, well, let's really look at why it's occurring. Is it occurring because exactly, let's take Mitzi's work with the astronauts. Is it because of their age? Is it because of overuse? Is it because of the equipment that they're using? Is it because the way that they're moving? Right? Is it their boots or their shoes or how they're coming off the truck? Or is it the way that they're holding the hose? Or is it the ladders they have to climb up or the patients they have to bring down on the gurneys or whatever the reason is? Let's figure out what that is. And then now let's think of some interventions. And what they figured out was, they applied the FMS. And once they applied the FMS, what they learned was in talking with them that it was really the understanding of the firefighters how to move. They never were taught how to move. Now you come in with an athletic trainer, right, who says, hey, look, I'm going to be able to teach you how to move. I'm going to strengthen up these areas. Oh, and by the way, I need more of these supplies. Could you imagine going to whoever makes the decisions about, you know, your supplies here and go, I just need more money. I need more supplies. Why? Justify it. Well, now you've got the research and the evidence to say this is the reason why. And that has a direct impact on the amount of resources that you're going to be giving. Because now it's not just a, well, this is what Jeremy thinks or this is what Mitzi or Josh thinks. Now you have proof. And like what I was told throughout my entire doctoral program, please don't confuse my opinion with the facts. All right? Because other than that, it's just your opinion. Who cares about your opinion? But if you can back it up with facts and research, now you've got something. Mm-hmm. And that's why it becomes so important. It's the most important thing that we can do, I think.
So then it kind of brings me back to the same question at the beginning. How do I decipher the facts?
Mm-hmm. Well, some of that is supposed to take place in some of the evidence-based learning, continuing education that everyone has to take these days. And some of those evidence-based practice sessions are brutal. But that's supposed to be where the research meets the practical application. And I say that's where it's supposed to be. On most sessions today, that's not occurring. It's staying in the research realm, you know, and you're looking at how much postural sway that someone has after a grade 2 concussion. I worked in the high school. How's that going to help you on the sidelines? Uh-huh. You know, it doesn't, you know, but how does that translate? And during that evidence-based continuing education, it needs to go from this is what we found in research, and this is what it means to the practicing athletic trainer. How can you use it in your training room, on the sidelines, and everything? And it's not happening in a lot of those sessions, but that's where it should be happening.
So the very applicable, this is what we found from a research side, this is how you apply it to your setting.
Yes.
Is there a specific name for that type of research besides applicable?
I'm not thinking of anything.
I'm
drawing a blank right now.
This is the first time in my history that I've ever stumped Dr. Laughlin. This is it.
Yeah, it's more of the practical applications, mm-hmm. I mean. But that's where it comes from, you know, or that's where I think some of the students that are going through the programs now, I think they're getting a little bit more of it in their undergraduate education, and so they're probably better equipped to interpret some of the studies, because that wasn't taught in my undergraduate education. Mm-hmm. I didn't get that until grad school, and it might have been my second or third year of graduate school before I really got into it. And so I didn't receive that when I was a practicing athletic trainer. I mean, so it's something that for the athletic trainers that are already out in practice, that it should be coming in that evidence-based practice.
Yeah, I think
there's a lot of evidence in those sessions, but there's not a lot of practical knowledge.
I think I took one class called Test and Measures, and that was mm-hmm. where we had to test something and put in the data and measure it and see if it was significantly. Mm-hmm. And that was about the only exposure I got to that. So mm-hmm. I am a big fan of the new way we're educating athletic trainers, presenting a more consistent result in the athletic trainer. And I know a lot of people, a lot of the older school ones, aren't a big fan of the Masters of Athletic Training, but I think that it's better for us as a profession as a whole. So I think being able to look at this research and decipher and being around, you know, Dr. Laughlin at U of H is a really cool opportunity because, you know, obviously Josh has a good relationship and they can bounce things off each other. Like you said, Dr. Knobloch is really
right
good at
that. She's right down the hall from us. Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah. So, and I have her bio link there, and she's got several papers that she's publishing soon and several that are out already. So one of the things in studying epidemiology I want to know is, what's the most random or interesting fact that you or connection that you've come across?
Probably the most interesting fact was this whole we went several years of looking at the NASA astronaut shoulder rates, injury rates and everything, and no one ever wanted to put the finger back on the astronaut that they just may be getting older and therefore have a higher injury risk. Is in normal population, you know, there's these nice little graphs and it's a stair step increase. As you get older, the number of shoulder injuries goes up. But somehow, you know, all the educated people at NASA didn't want to believe that.
So you're just overlooking one key component and it mm-hmm. kind of throws
you're
everything
off. Older.
Right. Yeah. And you hate to say, hey, you're just getting old, live with it, you know, or it's more of you're getting older, there's a higher probability of this, and if it happens, we need to take care of it. I mean, mm-hmm. it's not that, hey, you just have to live with it. It's like, no, if it happens, we know it's going to happen more often. We'll take care of it when it does.
That's how I got these bifocals, these progressive lenses, yeah.
Just getting older.
That's exactly what they told me. Asked me how old I was. I said I was 42. I said, about your age, this is about when it starts to happen. You're statistically right in there. Didn't make me feel any better, but it happens.
Normalized you.
Yeah, that's right.
All right, and I think Josh asked this earlier, but again, if you have a tip or a help and for people understanding, like me, understanding epidemiology, understanding some of the research, what do you think that would be?
For folks that have a statistics or a math phobia, and there's folks out there that just, you know, kind of lock up when math goes on, that don't be afraid to read articles, but read the introduction, the first two or three paragraphs, and then skip to the conclusions.
There you go. That's
okay.
That's awesome.
And it's better to, that will give you the general drift of the whole article. Okay. But you skip the math in between. Now, it's not as good as if you could read the whole article, but you're getting a lot of information. You're learning a lot from reading those two parts of the article.
The introduction and the conclusions.
Yeah. And if you're a math person, you do like I do, and you skip the introduction and you go straight to the methods mm-hmm. and the statistics. But that's because I'm a math person, so there's not many of us out there.
So kind of like Josh was saying, was understanding why. So you read the introduction. This is why we're doing it and what we're looking to answer. And the conclusion is we either answered it one way or another. So the introduction and the conclusion. Mm-hmm. So don't be afraid of them. Go for them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Then how do we apply this? How does this make sense to what I'm doing?
Yeah. And certain journals have that application part, like the Journal of Strength and Conditioning Research. They actually have, you know, all journals have the introduction, the methods, the results, the discussion, And then they have another section right at the end, practical applications. How is someone that is a strength coach, how is someone that's a soccer coach, whatever the article was about, how are they going to apply it to their athletes today?
Do you think that's something that we should do in our profession?
For certain types of studies, it's very helpful. I mean, if you're talking about the difference in two different orthopedic surgery types of surgery, I'm not so sure.
Sure.
But for a very clinically oriented profession, it helps. Because it goes down to how can someone use this in, you know, their practice today.
It's just
another paragraph.
Mm-hmm. Along those lines, do you think that, and I don't know how many epidemiologists that are athletic trainers exist, you're the only one that I know of, but do you think that practicing athletic trainers should have access to an epidemiologist? I mean, you brought that up before, but how important, or let me rephrase it. Now you're seeing a trend where analytics is huge in everything, right? Like, think of the movie Moneyball.
Mm-hmm.
Analytics is huge.
Right.
And when I think about epidemiology, statistics, research, analytics is something that kind of comes up. How important do you think having somebody with that knowledge on a sports medicine team is?
I don't know if depending on the size of the team, I mean, an epidemiologist, because we deal in big numbers, would be more at the larger groups, mm-hmm. or more on a population level rather than on individual school or school district, mm-hmm. level. But I think it'd be important to have access to one to say, hey, what do you think? This is happening at our school or whatever, to just talk through some ideas and to see if something's there.
Sounds like a good continuing education topic, Bob Marley, if you're listening.
There you go.
Lindsay Laughlin. All right, well.
Before you go, I know you got to get it. It is March when we're recording this.
March.
National Athletic Training Month. So I want you to take a second and thank an athletic trainer that has been important to you in some form or fashion. Mitzi, I'm going to ask you the same thing. If you will say thank you to an athletic trainer.
Other than the ones that I've already thanked before?
Yes.
All right, Mitzi, I'll let you go first.
Although he's no longer a practicing athletic trainer, I'm going to thank my very first athletic trainer in high school, Sam Russell. He is now an administrator in Louisville ISD, but he was the head athletic trainer at Louisville High School when I was a senior, or actually when I went through school, but I was actually a student athletic trainer my senior year.
Gotcha.
So I would thank him for getting me in the profession.
I'm going to thank Susan Houlihan. Susan was and still is the director of athletic training services at Santa Barbara City College. And at a time where I really had no idea what I wanted to do or where I wanted to go, she gave me an opportunity to observe her and what she does. And I was fascinated by it because it combined everything that I loved, which was, you know, the human body and how it worked and how it moved and when it's broken, how to fix it. And she allowed me to shadow her. And then I became one of her students. And then from there, I got accepted to my athletic training program at Cal State Northridge. But a little piece of history on Susan Houlihan. I think it's the 8th edition of the Arnheim book. She wrote part of the chapter on the Jobst boot, and she was one of Arnheim's students. How about that?
Very cool.
Thanks, Susan.
All right. Mitzi, I got a question on YouTube. Kat Mars watching live. She says, how can an older AT that may not have the educational / research background begin to apply the studies, i.e. NATA journal, or should we wait for additional studies? And then how do we know?
I think the first thing you need to do is read to understand the studies. And sometimes you have to read quite a few studies before that understanding gets there, and then you can start applying it once you kind of figure out what's going on. But on the first article that you read, even if you just read the introduction and the conclusions, sometimes it doesn't click of how you might be able to apply this. But as you read a few more, then things will start becoming more clear. So it's kind of like, I mean, you got to jump in with both feet.
Yeah, so you got to invest some time in it to mm-hmm. get understanding to apply it. All right. So, Kat, hopefully that answers your question. And on the same lines, I want to thank Rob Kimmel. He's no longer a practicing athletic trainer. He works for like medical sales, I think Stryker, one of those type things. But same deal. He was the athletic trainer my freshman year at Dobie High School, and I talked before, me and my buddy Kevin, we did some really stupid things, and I don't know how I made it through that program. I guess that's why there's three athletic trainers during my 4 years, but he just took the chance on me and, you know, came and interviewed me, gave me the opportunity, and he kept me around, taught us enough stuff for me to stick it out. So Rob Kimmel, thanks for allowing me to be an athletic trainer and getting me started. So Josh, any final questions, thoughts? Mitzi?
Thanks for having me here. It's been great.
If someone wants to find out more about you or some of your research, I have a link to your bio there. So if you go to, I just actually Googled Mitzi Laughlin epidemiology, I think is what I Googled. And then, or you can go to U of H and Google Mitzi Laughlin or what other ways is it easy to find
you? I have a U of H webpage and my CV's on the U of H page. So, yep. And all contact information that people can email me or call me.
Facebook, Twitter, YouTube. Phone number, address, all sorts of different stuff here was to get in touch with Mitzi Laughlin, which again is also on the show notes, sportsmedicinebroadcast.com/epidemiology. Mitzi Laughlin was also on episode number 2 when she was the president of SWATA. So if you want to go back and listen to more from Mitzi, there you go. Josh, someone wants to get a hold of you.
You can email me, jbyellen, Y-E-L-L-E-N, at central.uh.edu. You can look us up on the MAT program webpage, www.hhp.uh.edu/MAT. We are just accepting our fourth cohort coming in, and we're going to be graduating our second cohort. They've all been scheduled for the BOC exam, so they'll be taking it between March 29th and April the 7th, and the results come out on April the 22nd. So this is priority number one, and I just met with them today, and I won't meet with them again until April the 10th so they can focus on what they need to do.
Very cool. Well, I believe that you have prepared them well.
I hope
as
so.
As well as you can, and then obviously the rest is up to them.
I hope so. I mean, it's not like my job depends on it. Right?
So, all right. This is sportsmedicinebroadcast.com/epidemiology. I do want to thank Sarah Balk over at Herd Sports Medicine on Twitter. She's out at Hereford High School. They participated with us in the student scavenger hunt and some of the other stuff we've done on social media, but she also recommended the podcast whenever somebody asked for athletic training related podcast. So she recommended the Sports Medicine Broadcast. So Sarah, thanks. Appreciate your support. And look forward to taking the West Texas Sports Medicine test with you here in a couple weeks. I am Mr. Jeremy Jackson on Twitter. And for Jeremy, Dr. Mitzi Laughlin, Dr. Josh Ellen, that is a wrap.